Yes, you hear laughter in the background. This is Rick Kogan. The show is After Hours. And we got a full house here. I'll introduce them all later, but I have to introduce the main guest of this next segment. My old friend Kevin Horan, we were colleagues at the Sun-Times. He, a photographer, me, a writer. And he went on. He left the Sun-Times and became a very, very successful freelance writer and the last gasp, I think, of the golden age of magazines. Do what?
Photographer, you said writer.
Did I really?
Yeah.
Did you ever write anything?
Oh, yeah.
But he has a script here, but we're not going to get into that. I'm saying that's so ridiculous. Yes, he's a photographer, one of the greatest photographers I've ever known, and I've known a lot of them. Chris Walker, Chuck Osgood, great Henry Hare Gill.
Thank you, Rick.
Fred Stein, who is sitting in here with us. In the old days of newspapers, there was a real wonderful collaborative nature between photographers and writers who'd go on stories together, and it was great. I hadn't heard from Kevin Horan in some time until he called and said, Rick, I've moved to a place near Seattle, like an island, and I've got a book. And I said, well, what is the book, Kevin? And he said, well, it's called Goats and Sheep, A Portrait Farm. He sent it to me, and I have, as you know, Kevin, been beyond wildly intrigued. It is a beautiful, beautiful book that it at the same time sort of is arresting and haunting to me. It is shots of portraits of goats and sheep. You tried first. You started to meet these guys when you went to Whidbey Island.
We moved there, and I had these new neighbors. And by the way, I'm really curious tonight because you're proposing to do a radio interview about pictures.
Yes.
And I want to see
not the first time I've done it. I've had visual artists in here. I've had Tony Fitzpatrick in here. It works.
Believe you.
Watch your sales jump. So you went, you and your wife, Nancy, and we'll talk about Nancy and her career in a while, went out to sort of, it's near Seattle Airport. You could still kind of continue being a international freelance photographer, but you wanted to, your kids were grown, your two boys were grown, one of them sitting here with his fiance, and you said, let's get out of the rat race and go someplace that's really beautiful. And this place, I've just looked online. That's the only advantage I see of anything online these days is you can look at pictures of other places. It looks beautiful.
It is. And we bought this cute little house on a country lane, just a short walk from downtown, this little town of 1,000. But across the street were about a dozen sheep. Not a real working farm kind of sheep. Just a guy who liked sheep around. And he must have fed them at the gate right across from where I parked my car, because every time I went out to get in the car, they would rush to the fence and start talking to me, probably because they're hungry.
Yeah.
But they had all these voices, you know.
And they were distinctive. They were all...
Yeah, it's like...
And all these... And you, as a visual guy, started to look at them. You know, look, I go to farm in the zoo. I have not been around sheep much in my life at all. So I think of them all as looking the same. It is, in goats and sheep, they are all unique.
Exactly. They really are. And, of course, there are different breeds and varieties and all of that. But just based on those voices, I started to... It made me stop and say, wait a minute, that guy is different from that guy. And people who spend time around any kind of animals will tell you, oh, sure, they've got personalities.
Could you tell it first? Because I've sort of fallen in love with some of the more attractive female sheep in here, and they are all named. Could you immediately tell a male from a female sheep?
Oh, God, no.
Can you must be able to now because you name them in the book.
Well, hell no. I know for a guy who's publishing a book about goats and sheep, I know frightfully little about goats and sheep. It's a little bit embarrassing, but because there are real enthusiasts out there.
Oh, sure.
So my approach is this visual one, and it's sort of about how we react to faces and how we create people out of pictures.
And your initial thought was to sort of get your camera, hop over the fence, say to the goat, stop there, like, exactly. Look this way, as if they were a know, professional model or something.
Yeah, I talked to the owner and said, I got this idea. I kind of want to make these formal studio portraits. And he said, oh, yeah, knock yourself out. That sounds great. You know, day one, leg goes over the fence, and they scatter like minnows, you know. And I thought,
How were you able to do this? I mean, it is obviously... you told me you spent a couple, and there is, ladies and gentlemen, for those 400,000 of you who still get a print Chicago Tribune on Sundays, a nice piece in there, not enough pictures, but a nice piece about Kevin and the book written by me. You had to have some kind of help getting these characters to, are posing for you, are they not?
In a way, yeah. We can get into the actual process, but to get started, those sheep across the street from me, there's not one of them in here. They are complete washouts.
Yeah, their contracts were too high.
Yeah, they were uncooperative. But I kept looking around, and I found this gal who was trying to start a goat cheese dairy just a couple miles up the road, and... I approached her, put this question to her. I thought she'd say, you're crazy. And she said, oh, that sounds fun. Come on over. And went over. And her goats go into the milking stall twice a day. She handles them. They walk indoors, outdoors. She had a shed where we could work. So it was perfect. And so some of those are in the book.
You built a kind of studio in
Correct.
There, right?
So I need a building. I'm not going to build a whole building. I want to keep the sun off it and the rain off it. But I bring in what is the studio. The original idea was, a goat walks into a portrait studio. This is what happens. And they want to take it home and put it on the wall. But practically, that's not how it went. The studio goes to them. So it's a backdrop. It's half a dozen light stands with strobes.
So a couple hours of setup.
Yeah.
And then you would have each goat for roughly 10, 15 minutes. So it varied.
It varied a lot. It could be 20 seconds and, Charleston is not down with the project.
Yeah.
You know, he's out of here. But others... they were very cool about it, and if it worked or didn't work, we would let them do it for a little while and then leave and come back.
Some of them seem, and this may be my lack of knowledge of sheep and goats, but some of them actually seem to be posing for the camera. You see, and you also seem to have gotten many of them focusing on the camera. I mean, they seem to be looking at the camera. Am I being the idiot photo?
You're not being the idiot, but you are being a little bit misdirected by me.
Okay.
That they're not, they look like they're posing because I wanted these formal portraits. But can you tell a goat just to pose, look to the right, look to the left? Some of them acted like they knew what to do.
Did they really?
Yeah, it was kind of funny. Yeah. But in general, it's a matter of waiting for them to do something that is what I was looking for. And often I didn't know exactly what I was looking for until it happened.
How many goats and how many sheep are in this book? I did not frankly count them.
Oh, that is what a great question. I think it's about 49 total.
Yeah.
And I think six of them are sheep. The rest are goats.
Do you find goat faces more interesting?
You know, I do. And it took me a while. One of the pictures from that very first day, I think four pictures from that very first day are in the book because it worked so well. And one of them is a sheep, Lizzie, and she's gorgeous, and people love her. But in general, I got distracted by goats because they are really kind of, they're life of the party animals, you know. And the sheep takes a little more discernment to see some intelligence in there behind those eyes.
One thing that again impresses me from a, you know, this city locked nature boy that I would like to be is the different looks. I mean, there are, I don't know if these are all different breeds or if they're
they
different
are.
And there's so many. They look like completely different animals.
Yeah, and, you know, goats and sheep are everywhere on the planet and have been with us for thousands of years. So there are all these different breeds that have developed. And this could be, you know, those first pictures that worked were 10 years ago.
Wow.
It's kind of weird for me to think of that. I could spend another 10 years on this easily. It could go worldwide. I mean, there is a lot of variety there.
Yeah. It's a magnificent book.
Thank you.
Also, it contains some writing by photographer Kevin Arend and a really amazing essay by a woman named Elena Passarella.
Oh, isn't she wild?
That takes you back. It begins 65 million years ago, ladies and gentlemen. And she does in about four pages, brings us right up to today. We got to take a short break. We'll be back with Kevin. You can go to his website, which is easy, kevinharan.com. I'm talking on air, off air, all the time with my friend, my old friend, Kevin Harran, who now lives on an island near Seattle in the Northwest, and whose book, Goats and Sheep, A Portrait Farm, is one of the most striking, compelling, artful, and in its way, thought-provoking books that I have ever encountered. I mean, I would have had Kevin on the show if they were if they look like, you know, cartoon drawings of sheep and goats. But they are. I'm haunted by these, and I've got to think, Kevin Harran, that when you were shooting these and taking these portraits, the goats and sheep somehow didn't just get under your skin, but they got into your head. I mean, I'm not talking about directly anthropomorphizing animals, but you have to toss some human qualities onto them, I would think.
Absolutely. You know, maybe the first notion was, oh, this would be kind of funny.
Yeah.
But very quickly, you start looking at them, and you see, you're looking into those eyes, and you're thinking, wait a minute here, there's something going on in there. I may not understand it.
Mm-hmm.
It may not be what's going on in our heads, but it's a real thing. And there's been a lot of work about this, both scientifically and in a literary way, about what is in the heads of animals, animal
sure.
consciousness. There's a guy, Charles Foster, who wrote this book, and he lived like a badger for a number of weeks, you know, lived in a burrow and ate grub worms. And it's all this work in figuring out what's inside that head with using those senses.
This talented writer Elena Passarello addresses that in her opening essay, which is not a long it's not a long essay at all, but it is very incisive and again very thought-provoking, where she kind of makes a connection or argues that there is a connection that is as ancient can be.
Oh, yes. She starts her essay, and this thing is a mind blower, with the first mammals, by which she means, well, both humans and sheep and goats came from that creature. And she spends a day with those guys on a branch after the dinosaurs begin to fade. And, as you said, brings it all the way up to the future.
You've been doing this, Kevin Harran, for a decade now. It had to have changed the way in which you look at... You're a city kid, and I think maybe when the family was living in Oak Park, maybe you had a dog or two, but that doesn't make you a nature boy. This must have, and living where you live, changed your perspective about the world in which you live.
It did. It wasn't done from an activist animal rights point of view at all.
Yeah, I mean, as you said 2 seconds ago, you thought it'd be fun.
Yeah, exactly. But you get into trying to figure out what's going on with those guys, and it actually makes you think about, just as the portraits are very similar to the human portraiture I did for years and years, it makes you think about looking at all creatures with this sort of empathy and trying to understand the world as someone else sees it. And, I mean, you can extrapolate that to our political world.
Absolutely.
It's really about opening yourself. I had someone write me out of the blue and said, oh, well, I see what you're doing. It's not so much you're making them human, but you're drawing something out about ourselves. I thought she was so insightful.
Yeah.
That it's the way we appreciate all the other creatures that are around us. Two-legged or four-legged.
Or should. Yeah.
Yeah, the way we can.
Yeah, the way we...
And what you said about kind of being haunted by the pictures is exactly what I was going for, because I want the viewer to be in the place where they're a little bit unsettled. They don't really know what's going on with this picture. Am I just seeing, like, a trick? Or am I anthropomorphized? Yeah. Or am I seeing some actual life spirit behind that creature?
See, one of the other things about it, and you know, because I've written about you and this book and gone through this book maybe a dozen times or more, I have found myself being drawn to particular goats and or sheep more so than other goats or sheep, because I think, well, this one, like Sweet Pea, you look like you could be a friend of mine, and you actually look kind of like a friend of mine, which is, I guess, one of the things you're getting at. And this Emmy sheep with horns and
she's a sweetheart.
Sort of dark fur, and how attached did you become? I mean, was it a kind of shoot and shoot and goodbye kind of thing?
I'm sorry to say, I have not continued any deep friendships.
Well, I wouldn't be that sorry. I think that's probably very good. What about with the people? The people,
they gave me so much. You know, they really put themselves out. You asked about Emmy. I met her at the Island County Fair. I went over there, and I thought, well, I haven't... The county fairgrounds is a half mile. I can walk to it from my house. And I thought, I've never really explored this possibility. I go over there, and I'm looking around the goat barn, and I see this family. You know, it's these three girls and a boy, school age. They're getting their goats ready to show. And I thought, who do I talk to here? And their dad is helping them, this really nice guy, George Johnson. And I put... again, the same proposal to him. This is what I want to do. He says, gee, that sounds great. I'm like, what? What is wrong with you, man? But yeah, I'm going to take it.
Yeah.
I'll take that answer. And I came back the next day, set up all the stuff just outside the goat barn. And this guy, I mean, he was on his hands and knees trying to get these goats into the way I light it, there's one little sweet spot where they have to be. And he was working with me. And he usually had to be behind the goat, you know, at the...
When you began to share your feelings with the owners of these animals, those must have been some intense conversations. I mean, they must have at some point said, God, you get it.
They really love their animals, you know, and they're just... I think they put all that work into it for me, some guy they were not really getting anything out of, because they love those animals and they're flattered by this very special attention.
And you gave them all prints.
Yes.
Yeah, that's very nice. Where are the prints? Are they on the wall? Are they framed on the wall?
I hope so.
Yeah. Kevin Horan is going to be here after the news, too, for a few more minutes. But he will be Tuesday night at Volumes Bookstore on Lincoln Avenue. I hear it's... Milwaukee Avenue, sorry. And it's going to be crowded, but get in there. You'll also be Wednesday.
In East Troy, Wisconsin, at Inklink Books. They have a dinner book talk.
Wow.
And in both cases, I'll be with, it's in conversation with the novelist Jane Hamilton.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's going to be great.
Well, Jane Hamilton, if you don't know her, you certainly should. The reception for the book's been, just what I can tell online and in whatever idiotic fashion I am privy to, is something of a sensation. I mean, people are loving this book, I guess, because it's one of the few goats and sheep portrait farm books that they've ever seen.
I guess so.
Yeah.
It does seem to connect with people.
Yeah. Got to be very, very gratifying. Okay, we got to take a commercial break, then we'll get some news, and we'll carry on with Kevin Horan. Welcome back. I have a few more minutes with Kevin Horan. We've been talking about his book, Goats and Sheep, A Portrait Farm, which is a gathering of portraits of a lot of sheep and goats, and a brilliant essay by a woman named Elena Passarella, and a very nice piece, too, by Kevin himself about what he, sort of explaining the process of getting into this on Whidbey Island, where he lives with his wife, Nancy, who is a noted, a wonderful person, but also a noted and incredibly gifted novelist, first of the best-selling novel Loving Frank, which took her a while to write, didn't it?
It did.
So, Nancy, if you're listening, I miss you and I adore you. And there's a new book out, too, relatively new, right?
Well, since then, yes, Under the Wide and Starry Sky.
Which is about well, this is great. She writes about an architect, Frank Lloyd Wright. Then it's about Robert Louis Stevenson. And then she will do the great novel of the newspaper man, Rick Kogan.
I'm almost sure of it.
These scandalous love affairs of Rick Kogan. You're also in here with your son, who I probably met when he was a tiny little boy.
Probably so.
Harry, who in print is Harrison, his lovely fiancée, Holly. They're getting married in 27 days. And Fred Stein, another great photographer. If you used to get the Land's End catalog, you saw the work of Fred Stein, which was, we both great friends with Gary Comer, who started that thing. Now that this book is finished, Kevin, and you're holding it in your hands, and you'll be with Jane Hamilton Tuesday at Volumes Bookstore on Milwaukee Avenue, and in East Troy at another bookstore I don't know, but looks nice online, looks nice, with Jane Hamilton. What's next? I mean, you obviously, this book obviously changed your life in some, I think, profound creative way.
Yes. After years and years of media work, working for newspapers and magazines, it was really great to, this was my own assignment, and I could go into it in all the depth and length that I cared to. And it really did change me in that way and introduce me to the art world. And so that's what I'm doing now. And I have a couple of other projects in the works, whereas this one is black and white and very crisp and planned out. The next one I'm working on is pretty much the opposite in every way, color and really amorphous and hard to see what's in the pictures. And
well, you can see, and maybe you can get a hint of it on your, I love your website. I think your website is great. His website is kevinhoran.com. I guess you can order the book on your website, or you're not that.
No, we're just.
See, you and I are such.
Would that be
former,
a good idea?
Because we're former newspaper guys, we're such internet idiots. It's like, well, some people.
Oh, you can do that?
You can buy anything on my website, blah blah blah, but you can buy it anywhere books are sold. I would prefer you to go to a bookstore, those things called bookstores, and get Goats and Sheep.
But
you can do it, you can also do it online. When you see on Whidbey Island, when you see yes, you do, a goat or a sheep, do you ever say to yourself, wow, I got to shoot that. That's a great face. It's like, you're like Fellini, who used to put into his movies people with great faces.
Well, yeah. I do kind of drive by and say, boy, I keep meaning to stop in that farm, but I got to stop it. I just have to stop.
Kevin, you seem very, very happy, and I am very, very happy for you. Fred, it's great to see you. Holly, it's good to meet you. And Harry, congratulations on the wedding, and congratulations on this book.
Thank you so much.
Everybody, people would stop at my desk at work, and the cover, who's this cover girl?
Oh, that's Bella.
Bella. And would just start, this is my private desk, and they would just start plowing through it and go, what is this? It is.
It's kind of worn. You might need a new copy.
I can buy one. No, this is the way it came. This is the way it came in the mail all the way from the far northwest. Kevin, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
We'll take a break, get some commercials in, and then talk about a young entrepreneur in the publishing biz. Welcome back. We're making the great exchange here because my guest a few months ago, Savvy, when was it? When was I up at DePaul?
I want to say probably in February, if I had to guess.
This is her first radio interview.
Yes.
Savvy Lizer with her parents and her husband in here. So I'm up at this class, and I'm yammering about, oh, journalism, this and journalism, that and this. Nice young woman comes up after the class and goes, well, I wonder if we could talk about a few other things. I go, sure. She goes, well, I have my own publishing company. I've written 5 or 6 books. I have an online. I said, are you really a student here? So I'm glad you sent me these books, and these books are charming.
Thank you.
These are the Forever, F-U-R-E-V-E-R, Home Friend Story.
Yes.
That's one of your companies, right?
Well, that is my company. So I've published books outside of that as well, but this is my business that I started up myself that I run. So I do all my books through my own company, Forever Home Friends, and I do other products through them as well. So, yeah, everything's through there.
So you're a graduate student at the Ball.
Yeah, I'm getting my master's in writing and publishing right now.
Why do you need a master's doing all you're doing now? I mean, you are so far, to my mind, ahead of the game. You're farther ahead of the game than 90% of the people I work with at the Tribune. I'm serious about
well,
that.
Thank you.
I'm serious.
Well, it's a funny story. So I actually had started this business without knowing that I had gotten into the graduate program yet. So I had applied to get a master's
degree. You did
degree.
Undergrad at Northwestern?
I did undergrad at Northwestern,
yeah. Studying what?
I studied communication with a film major and like a screenwriting specialization.
Okay.
Yeah. So then I applied to the master's program at DePaul. I was really interested in the program because I was interested in the ability to be able to teach college writing. So I wanted to have a master's for that. I started up this business without knowing that I had gotten into like the graduate assistantship program so that I could go to school without having to pay tuition since I couldn't afford it. So when I found out that I actually found out that I had gotten that assistantship the day the first 2 books launched in this series. And I was like, oh my God, I just started up a business. And then I was about to get married a month later as well. So I didn't think I had gotten into grad school. And then I planned my wedding thinking I wasn't going. And then I got in the day my books launched, so I was like, now I'm running a business, I have a wedding in a month, and I guess I'm going to school, too. So it was pretty exciting.
Well, all I can say is your parents and your husband are sitting here all looking pretty proud of this kid.
Well,
pretty
thank you.
Pretty proud of this kid. Why did you start the business? I mean, I kind of understand the unconventional route that one sort of is forced into in the weird, mm-hmm. wacky contemporary world of publishing. You know, I just had a guy who's written a pretty good book who can't get it published. He can't find an arm to do it. He's thinking, and most people don't want to go at this point the self-publishing route, though I think that is the way to go.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of pros and cons to both sides from what I've seen. With these books in particular, I mean, I had written a couple of these stories, and then there were a few reasons that I decided to kind of start up my own business. One being that I wanted to create more than just a book series. So I didn't want to just, you know, have a book that I work with on a publisher and then it comes out. I wanted to be able to create stuffed animals that go with these books. I wanted to create a business model where I donate part of the profits to animal shelters. I wanted to be able to partner up with local shelters in Chicago and do events together. I wanted to have consistent branding that I created with my own art and all of that as well. So for me, it was not just that I wanted a book series out there. I had an entire business model, and I wanted an entire like universe with these dogs that I wanted to create.
Now, who is Brenda Clemente? She's your illustrator for one of these or all of these? Or
so each book's actually illustrated by a different artist. So that was another thing I wanted to do, because one of my goals with this series was that I wanted to show the diversity of different kinds of dogs and the diversity of backgrounds and different stories that they come from. So I wanted to have a different illustrator for each book. So I actually illustrated one of them myself, the book Justin
Wrigley.
I know, I've
seen that. Yeah. I've got that here.
So I did that one, and then I worked with a different illustrator on each of the other 3 books. I mean, I met them all through various routes.
Which route?
So, yeah, there's a couple funny stories on this one, too. So, the illustrator of Smile Chewy, her name is Christy. I actually met her on an airplane. So, I'm a kind of person who talks to strangers on airplanes. Some people think that's weird.
I don't, honey, I don't doubt that for a second.
So I was on an airplane and I was talking to my family. I think I was talking to Tyler about, you know, a new project that I was writing or something I was working on. The girl in the next aisle over was like, "Oh, are you a writer? I'm an illustrator. I'm looking to get into illustration." And this was before I had started this. This was like right before. But I said, "You know what? Like, let me take your card." We exchanged information. And then when I started working on this, I reached out to her and said, "Let me get some art samples. Let me see what you're working on." And so then we drew up a contract and worked on that. With Brenda, the illustrator of Princess Allie, I found her through, I think, from SCBWI, the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. I put out a call for illustrators that I was going to be interviewing over their listserv, and someone recommended her to me. And then the illustrator of Kringle's Christmas is Jan Spivey Gilchrist, who's a very well-known illustrator in Chicago. She's illustrated over 90 children's books. And
how did you find her?
So I actually met her at the Children's Literature Fair on the South Side a couple years ago. And at this time, I was doing a lot of freelance copy editing, and she was looking for an editor to work on a new book with her. So we exchanged information, and I got to know her not just as like a colleague, but also as a friend. And then when it came time for this book, I really wanted to get some of her illustrations in there because I know they're so beautiful. So I talked to her about that.
You have a great website.
Thank you. It is Savvyleiser.
That's SavvyLeiser.com, where you tout yourself as author and artist and editor and journalist and lover of ampersands.
Yes.
This is a business. I mean, this is another aspect of your life where you are open to editing, helping people edit books, starting web pages, doing, which I'd always done, never had a web page. You would think, experienced journalist, I wouldn't know how to start a web page. Where do you get this? I'm not going to get your dad and mom on and say, "Hey, where'd she get these entrepreneurial genes?" Where do you get these entrepreneurial genes?
I don't know. I guess I've just always been a person who's had a lot of different interests. And when you start something up yourself, you're allowed to wear many different hats and you're able to play to all your different strengths and put your skills to use. So
what would you say is the basis of it? Is it the love of words and literature? What is the foundation of your...
Everything for me comes back to a love of storytelling and sharing stories with other people. And for me, my entire mission as an author and as a creator is that I want to use the power of storytelling to normalize a better world for everyone, a world with more equality, a world, you know, where everyone's kinder to each other and more empathetic. And I think that through sharing stories with each other, that's kind of one of the best ways you can do that, because instead of just preaching something to someone or just telling someone outright how you want them to behave, you can show it in action and help someone build an emotional connection to a character or to a story.
With all due respect to DePaul University, aren't you bored in graduate school?
Not at all. I love DePaul University. I think it's wonderful.
No, you can say that, but I'm like, wait a minute. Are you, Dan, don't you? I mean, you're listening to this. I mean, I'm saying, wait a minute. What are you doing in school? You should be running the school, for God's sake.
Oh, my God.
Well, you are getting, when do you get out?
I actually graduate this June, so this is my final quarter at DePaul.
I'm assuming you're going to get A's. I don't know what to do.
I hope so. Yeah. I mean, what I appreciate about the school there is I've had some fabulous resources that I've really appreciated. For example, I've done a lot of work with their Coleman Entrepreneurship Center in their business school. So I've been able to enter a lot of their business-related competitions as a startup with Forever Home Friends, and I've been able to win some grant money, and I've been able to get my business in front of a lot of interested people through using their resources. Through the English department, I've been doing a fabulous sequence on writing novels, and I've been working on a young adult novel with them. So I have definitely been expanding a lot of what I've been doing on top of this business. So I think that my time in school has been very valuable.
Okay, what do you think you're going to do when you get out of school on June whatever?
Well, my goal is...
What are your plans? What are your plans? Obviously, there's more books, obviously.
Yeah.
Forever Home Friends thing. Is that a... T-shirt?
Yes, so I'm wearing a Forever Home Friends t-shirt. This is from the book Just Me Wrigley. I did a design where Wrigley, who's one of the dogs, is DJing, because when I was drawing her in
Of course he is. Yeah. Of course he is. You can do anything in a book.
When I was drawing her in one of her positions, I looked at the picture from a distance and I was like, it looks like she should have a little turntable and be spinning some records. So I just drew that and put it on a t-shirt, and now it's one of my favorite t-shirts. So they're available for sale on ForeverHomeFriends.com as well. But in
now you can get the Forever Home Friends from your website, I have to believe, yes?
Yeah, so foreverhomefriends.com is where you can get them. So that's the website I built for this business. So that's forever with a U because I love the pun. So F-U-R-E-V-E-R, homefriends.com. That's where you can get the books and the t-shirts and the stuffed animals. And everything's available on there. And, you know, if you buy through there, we give 10% of our profits to animal shelters. They're also available on Amazon as well, but I always prefer doing them through my website because then I get the entire...
You have now, unless I've miscounted, you have four?
There's four books in the series. I'm currently working on the fifth without a set release date on that. But the next kind of big project I'm working on with the series is that I want to get stuffed animals made for all of the dogs. So right now I have a stuffed animal to go with Smile Chewy that's made. Originally, when I started...
You have a t-shirt for Wrigley.
Yeah, I have a t-shirt for Wrigley. I have a stuffed animal for Chewy, but my goal is to have a stuffed animal for all of them.
Sure.
Because I want this to be like, you know, there's a book and a stuffed animal, and you can hug the stuffed animal and know the story and feel a connection to them.
What's been the reception? I know you've gone out and done signings and events at various bookstores. What's been the reaction? I would think positive.
Yeah, generally positive. It depends on the event, how well I do in terms of sales. I think like the Printers Row Literature Festival in Chicago has been probably my best event. I love doing that one. Generally, I like to do events where I partner up with animal-related things. So, like, sometimes I'll do a book signing at a pet store. Sometimes I'll do... this past December, I teamed up with a live rescue in one of the Chicago rescues to put on a Happy Holidays party.
You told me about that.
Happy Holidays party was really fun. So, it was also the launch party for our fourth book, Kringle's Christmas. So, we put on this party where there was a big Christmas tree, and there were paw print-shaped cookies and all this stuff, and we invited people to come to it, and I sold and signed books there, and we had Christmas music playing, and we also collected some donations for the shelter. So it was a really fun event that benefited the shelter, and also I was able to sell a lot of books there. So some events like that, taking a more creative approach, like I love doing events in bookstores as well, but I also tend to do better when I can partner up with a shelter or someone else.
That's your activist side, too.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's your activist side. If I can ask, what does your husband do?
So Tyler,
he's a nice looking guy sitting here.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Tyler is a software developer at Solstice.
What is Solstice?
It's a company that's located in the West Loop.
Do you collaborate? I mean, you do a lot of things on the internet.
We don't collaborate, actually. Our careers are pretty separate for the most part. Like, we'll help each other out, but for the most part, like, I run my business and he goes to his job and we work on different schedules. But yeah, it's a good time.
How long have you been married?
We got married in September of 2017, so a year and a half.
Okay.
Yeah.
How much is that t-shirt?
This t-shirt is $25 on foreverhomefriends.com.
How many t-shirts do you have?
Do I have for sale? Like, it's unlimited stock because I get them printed and shipped through a warehouse somewhere.
I mean, how many different styles?
Oh, different styles. So I have one in yellow, I have one in blue, and one in white. So there's three colors you can get of the adult size, and then there's like a turquoise color for the kid sizes.
What about your other business? How's that going? The sort of editorial services that you have that you advertise. I mean, you'll read books, you'll critique books, you will obviously help would-be authors. Who comes to you for that?
So often in terms of doing some of my freelance editing services, I find some authors who, sometimes there'll be authors who have a really interesting story to tell, but they don't, you know, maybe their strongest skill isn't like grammar or punctuation or those like mechanical things that aren't always the most fun part. But I love those parts of it. I think like breaking down a language in a mathematical way can be super fun. So sometimes people will come to me and say, hey, I've got this story I want to tell, but I don't know how to use verb tenses or punctuation. So I need you to read it over and edit it for me. And that's great. Sometimes I just do recurring work for like a finance blog or something. So just really anyone who needs something looked over, I'm happy to edit.
How do they find you?
How they found me? Generally, a lot of people have found me through SCBWI. People have gotten my business card through those events. I'm in a lot of writing critique groups, so people talk to each other and word of mouth kind of spreads, so I've found people that way as well.
What's a writing critique? I mean, what do you mean a writing critique group?
So often groups of writers will meet up together.
Oh, I know about those.
Oh,
you mean just like writers groups?
Yeah, just writers groups. Yeah, just to give each other feedback on a writing, yeah.
You are some kid. How old are you?
26.
Wow. Where do you live?
I live
not in exactly,
the,
but
oh yeah, I live in the uptown neighborhood.
Do you have brothers and sisters?
I have one brother, and he lives out in the East Coast.
What, is he in prison or something? Is he a slacker? Just joking. Parents are here.
No, he's a great
what
guy.
What does he run?
He actually runs his own business as well.
Oh, it's hard to believe, huh?
Well, he's very into like Dungeons and Dragons and tabletop gaming. So he started his own business to produce content for games that he sells online. So that's what he does.
Keep you after the news too. Where did you grow up and go to high school?
So I moved around a little bit. I'm originally from the Chicago suburbs, and then I went to high school in Pennsylvania, actually. So we moved out there, and that's actually where I met Tyler. We met in high school.
Nice.
And then I came back to this area to go to Northwestern for college, and then stayed out here, and then my family moved back here. So, you know, it all worked out for us. We're all Chicago people at
heart.
Well,
and also, it's a good, and I'll talk to you after the news, it's also a good writer's town.
I love the writing community here.
No question about it. We got a break for some commercials, then we got to get some news, then I'm going to have Safi play co-host while I interview, I'll tell her what it is.
Ooh, okay, cool.
We're going to interview somebody about One Book, One Chicago.
Oh, that's exciting.
You know, that is good. Maybe, I have no doubt that within a few years, whatever one of your books will become the pick for One Book, One Chicago.
That'd be cool.
So, we'll be back in a couple minutes. Okay. Welcome back. In September, I still have Savvy Leiser in here. She's going to co-host for a while I interview my friend, Max Grinnell. But the reason I'm interviewing Max is in September, I got a kind of scoop on the latest One Book, One Chicago selection, which was an unusual one, I think. Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep by Philip K. Dick, that 1968 novel set in a world as he imagined it. Max, how are you?
I'm very well, Rick.
I'm glad to hear
that.
You too, pal. Max is a historian, a professor, and an all-around lover of all things city. His website is Urbanologist. Max, meet Savvy Leiser, who is the next generation of Chicago literary personalities here. She's a kid.
Hello,
I met at
Savvy.
I know. I don't
Hi,
know if you've been.
Nice
I don't
to
know
you.
If you've been listening. She's a kid. I met at. She was a student at DePaul, and I said, after class, she goes, could I tell you about the business I have? She has her own publishing business. She has an editing business. Max, you are coming to town to start some tours in connection with the One Book, One Chicago thing. When do they start?
Rick, they have already started. That's the amazing thing. Yesterday, we were in Uptown with a group of 40. Then we moved on to the Loop. We were talking everything from transit history in the Loop. We were talking the creation of the Michigan Avenue Historic Streetscape facade. And we have a bunch more programs coming up where I'm going to be in Canaryville tomorrow night at the library talking about unbuilt projects throughout the city.
See, that's one that really intrigued me about unbuilt projects in the city. Give us an idea. What is one?
Well, I mentioned Frank Lloyd Wright's proposed Mile High skyscraper, which is kind of wild. You know, he never set a specific place within the city, but it's kind of these aspirational moonshots for architecture. And it actually formed the inspiration for the Burj Khalifa. So that's kind of, or Burj Dubai, excuse me. So that's it. It's with us today in another form, if you will. Another one that I think people have been kind of always intrigued by is, of course, the proposed World Fair that Chicago did not end up having in 1992, which would have taken place where the Century of Progress in 1933 took place, which is right around the lakefront, Northerly Island. And those are two of the projects that I always think about as kind of these miraculous moments. You know, why didn't we have them?
Who's coming on these tours? Obviously, it's people like you and me. But otherwise, because I thought this was an unusual. I thought, and you know, I have thought other books were kind of unusual choices. I thought this was an unusual one, but in its way, kind of inspired too.
I think the idea is a great one. You know, get folks. You know, who might have this kind of passion for science fiction and thinking about how have we changed as a city. One thing, you know, whether it's either people's use of smartphones or how we understand, parse out the world around us through those devices. We don't have any flying cars on the tour. I'm sorry. For those you might be coming out, or there's no drone, BYOD, bring your own drone. But we do have all kinds of age ranges coming out for this. On the Uptown tour, we had folks from Northeastern Illinois University and some folks from DePaul. We had lifelong Uptown residents. One woman even added in a little bit about the celebrated Challenger Park, which of course extends on the east side of Graceland Cemetery as a linear park, you know, two or three blocks long. Yeah. And thinking about that, not just as this green space, but also as like this moment for people to run, to jog. And folks who are listening who know Uptown, who know Buena Park, know that there's that a little enclosed dog area called Challenger Bark.
Aww.
So there's, yeah, right? See?
Yeah.
Who doesn't, these are our fur babies.
I know. I'm a dog mom, so it's
okay.
All about
see?
That.
See? Yeah. Abby knows what I'm talking about.
She does.
Just thinking about how we use space, you know, we stopped by the Uptown Theater. We talked about kind of even the transformation of retailing. I mean, I have students sometimes who are like, what's a department store? And I'm like, well, I like Target. And they're like, oh, you know, so just these kind of conversations, and we're trying to be present in place. I mean, people are welcome to take phones. You know, we had folks doing Snapchat, et cetera. But it's also like we saw people talking to each other, walking around, and it was really great.
Well, you were the guy to do it, Max. And let me know the next time you're in town for a lengthy stay, because you're one of my favorite radio guests, and we should just come on here and shoot the breeze about Lincoln Yards and new mayors and old mayors
goodness.
And everything else, don't you think?
Yeah. We can throw in some of the 78, too, if you want. that'd be, you know, Rick, if you don't mind, I'd love to mention, too, for folks.
Sure.
We also have a kind of a fun trivia night that's part of this, hosted by yours truly. It's on April 16th at the G-Man Tavern there in the celebrated Wrigleyville, much changed neighborhood.
The ever-changing Wrigleyville, yeah. The unrecognizable, to my mind, Wrigleyville.
Right. There's very few places left.
Yeah.
And that's at 7 p.m. on April 16th. So, if you are 21 and up, please come out for some prizes, some good conversation, and that's one of the other events that's coming up. So just want to put a little quick pitch in there for that.
Max, do you have all this stuff on your website, The Urbanologist?
It's on my website, and also folks go to shypublib.com.org. That's another place people can find
it. Go to Max's. Get to know Max. Go to The Urbanologist. Max is one of the Chicago, even though he doesn't live here all the time, he's a Chicago treasure. Max, it's always good to talk to you, man. Always
Thank
good.
You, Rick.
Have
Thank
fun on this stuff.
Me.
Have fun.
Yeah,
I'm glad to introduce you to Savvy.
It's nice to meet you.
She'll be doing the interview in a short while on this station or some other station. Count on it. Max, let me know when you're going to be in for a length of time, and we'll sit down for an hour on the show.
That sounds great.
All right, pal.
Be well. Take
Safe
care.
Travels,
Bye,
pal.
Rick.
Safe travels.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
So you're really part of the whole media scene now, aren't you, Savvy?
I guess so. It's super exciting.
This is your first radio show.
Yes, this is the first radio interview I've done. I'm super excited. I'd love to do these all the time. I'm having a great time.
Well, you're a great guest. There's no question about it. You have very nice parents, and you have a very nice husband, and you were. There's no dead time when you're on the air. Tell me again. I know you mentioned it when 10, 15 minutes ago. When you graduate in June, what is your plan? What the first day, and I'm assuming you, or the first minute you're out of school, what are you going to do?
So my plan, the second I graduate, is to focus all my time on growing this business. So actually, before I even graduate, starting May 11th, I'm going to be running a Kickstarter for kind of my first step toward expanding this. So right now...
How do people find that?
So if you go to Kickstarter.com and search Forever Home Friends in there, the page isn't live
yet. Don't forget, it's Forever.
Forever, yeah. Forever. And I'm also going to have updates about this on my website, and I have a YouTube channel, so I'll have updates about it on there, and on my Twitter, which is just Savvylizer, as my Twitter and Instagram. All my accounts are just under my name.
Go to her website. It's a fun way. You'll get lost there for a while. It's a real. I think it's a very, very fun website. Go ahead.
Oh, so I'm going to be running the Kickstarter from May 11th through June 10th, and what I'm going to be doing with that is taking pre-orders for all of our upcoming stuffed animals. Right now, we only have one of the four stuffed animals available for sale because I didn't have enough funds when I started to get prototypes made of
kid.
All four of them.
Didn't have enough funds. You're a college kid.
Exactly. So
you should be on Shark Tank, for God's sake.
You know, I always wanted to be on Shark Tank, but
it may happen. Don't kid yourself.
I get left off the stage there because I haven't made enough money yet. They are all about the big money, you know?
Well, after this Kickstarter thing, well, Shark Tank is in your future, and another appearance on this show is in your future, too.
If anyone's interested in pre-ordering any of our upcoming stuffed animals, they all come with little adoption certificates, so it looks like you adopted the dog. You can visit our Kickstarter page, Forever Home Friends, on there between May 11th and June 10th. That's the 30 days span.
But they'll find that if they go to your website.
If you go to my website, I'll be posting about it on there, doing updates about it on all the social media as well. But be on the lookout for that as a big thing that's coming next.
Congratulations on getting out of school. I expect you'll one day run this station, or who knows? Who knows?
Well, thank you.
You're a bright, talented young woman, and that, I always believe that passion is the motivating factor for success.
Thank you. And
you should be more successful than you are as a college kid. You're probably the most successful college kid entrepreneur I've met.
Well, that's awesome. Thank you.
I haven't met that many. But you are. You're a nice young woman. I hope for big things for you and your husband and your proud, proud parents. So thank you for coming in. And we'll do this again.
I would love to. Yeah, thank you so much for having me on the show. I had a wonderful time.
My pleasure. You had fun. Dan, didn't she have fun? Dan had fun, for
I had
God's
so
sake.
Much fun, yeah.
But I have the feeling you might be able to have fun almost anywhere. That's a great thing.
That's true.
We'll take a little commercial break, and then we'll hear from the Lakeside Singers.
When you're in love and you are wondering if he really is the one, there's an ancient sign sure to tell you if your search is over and done. Should be, and if he don't sting you, you're in a spell.
Whose voice is that?
Me.
Who's you? I'm sitting in here with two of my favorite people who've been on the show a number of times. Yeah, keep it plain, Dan. It's Josie Falbo, one of Chicago's great singers, who does not perform anywhere near as much as I or others would like her to perform. Josie, what is this from?
It's my new CD. It's not completed yet. This is the first cut. This is the world premiere.
Another world premiere for us, Dan Long.
And orchestration by Carrie Dedman, superbly done. And all these wonderful musicians, I'm in such awe, and I have such great respect for them who contributed to this CD. It's just
fun. You are also one of the great collaborators, and we have in here maybe the world's greatest collaborator in Bob Barker, who's the head of the energy, the engine of a group called the Lakeside Singers, that I have been in love with for, God, you guys have been together for almost, can it be 20 years?
20 years. Yes.
20 years.
Yes.
And Josie's been with me from the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
Tell me again. I know we've done this on the air before, mm-hmm. and we'll mention all of the upcoming shows. How did it start, Bob?
The group started because I was working in recording studios with a lot of pop and country singers, doing commercials and video.
This is kind of in the last days of Chicago being kind of the recording center of the universe.
Yeah, we were very, very big.
Yeah.
Mecca.
Absolutely.
We're Mecca.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually when I met Josie. And at the same time, I was working with the Grand Park Symphony Chorus, and my background was classical music as well.
Yeah.
So I decided to try to combine those two interests because I'd met wonderful singers on each from each of those pools of talent. And I called Josie as one of the first people I called and said, would you be interested in trying this experiment? So we've been at it now 20 years.
Yeah. How did you phrase, when you first approached Josie and some of these other incredibly talented professional singers, how did you first approach them with the idea? You know, it wasn't like, hey, let's get together and sing. It had to be a little...
It was almost that idea.
Really?
Because singers really, like everyone else, get tired of being pigeonholed.
Yeah.
They always want to do a bunch of different things. And so the idea of doing both classical and pop music on one concert with microphones and a band was interesting for
appealing.
Everybody just because it was different.
And Josie, what was it that appealed to you?
Well, I loved all those genres of music. I loved singing all of them, and we'd have a chance to showcase that in the concerts. And it was just fun to sing everything. I love singing opera. I love singing classical, and of course, jazz.
You see, that is one of the things, I guess, and you can both, Bob Boker and Josie Falbo, talk about this, is that there is a tendency to pigeonhole singers.
True. Yeah.
By their physicality, by their selection of tunes, and would you argue, both of you, that most singers are vastly more eclectic in their tastes than anyone would imagine, and vastly more talented in different genres than anyone would imagine? Would you say that, Bob?
I would say, actually, most musicians tend to be pigeonholed.
Yeah.
But their love of music is broader than that pigeonhole by far.
No question. And the pigeonhole is sometimes...
It's basic, where they first get hired.
But it's their commercial considerations, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. But the passion for doing good music is broader than any general pigeonhole. So actually we find over the years that the people that enjoy our concerts are really interested and have eclectic tastes, and now more than ever they can listen to all sorts of music very easily, and so they're exposed to more. The teenagers are.
Josie, and we'll be all over the map in this, you guys get to stay all the way till 11 o'clock because you're like night people.
Oh, yes.
When you decide to, how many CDs do you have?
I just have the first one out there, Taylor Street, Joseph Ebel Taylor Street. This one will be You Must Believe in Spring, which is based on Michel Legrand's beautiful song. That will be the title of this CD, but we're closing in on it. We're in a mixed stage now.
Let me ask you, too, because before we get into all the, you know, Lakeside Singers celebrating their 20th anniversary with concerts this Friday in Evanston at the incredible Nichols Hall, which is the great concert venues in the country, then in Naperville Saturday, and in Chicago at a certain church on Michigan Avenue on the 26th,
right.
Then you can go to lakesidesingers.com to buy CDs and do all that stuff. This is also, you know, the three of us have lived in an era where everything is changing, and the whole notion of making a CD is a vastly more involved project than it was 15, 20 years ago.
Oh, my goodness. For sure.
Yeah, everything has changed.
It's an endless process, it seems like, for me lately.
Well, and especially, too, Bob, in an era where, you know, when people used to make CDs, they were concerned with the kind of narrative drive of the CD.
Right, that one song was put after another.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Exactly. And now that doesn't exist anymore.
It doesn't. You're absolutely right. I think of all the hours we used to spend trying to sequence what song is going to be more powerful coming next on the program, and now people don't listen that way.
But Life is upbeat for all of us in here. Bob Bowker, Josie Falbo, Barb Bailey is here too. I'm Rick Kogan. We got to take a commercial, then we got to get some news, and these people are staying all the way till 11 o'clock because they're night people just like me and just like you. We'll be right back.
He's mine for the taking. I'm so happy at last. Maybe I dream, but he seems sweet. Golden as a crown. Asleep in me, he done told me. I'm walking with my feet off the ground.
That was the voice of Josie Falbo, who has only one CD to her credit, to one that I have played so much that you can't really used to be able to run record raw, but I've run that one raw. That is the first world premiere of a song that will be on her second CD, backed by some incredible musicians. I have to assume some of those musicians are part of the gang at lakesidesingers.com. That's the website you should go to. Bob Barker, who founded that group and who still runs that group 20 years ago, dedicated to the sort of bridging the worlds of classical and contemporary choral music. The membership is drawn from all walks of life. I mean, not from, you know, stumble bums on Lower Wacker, but and from all over this area. And they have to, Bob, audition. I think they have to audition every 2 years.
Well, we keep an eye on them all the time. But they are professional singers,
yeah.
and all of them have often numerous other jobs that they're working on, singing jobs, and often day gigs too to get them through. But many are teachers, and they come from a long way around. But the interesting part is actually that half of them are chosen for their skills in classical music.
Wow.
And the other half for their skills in a particular style of pop music, like blues or jazz or R&B or gospel or country music.
And so, there must be, but with you and in the Lakeside Singers, they get to cross over, so
true,
to speak.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it must be when someone has been, and I don't want to use that pigeonholed world again, when someone has been focused, for instance, on pop tunes for their whole career, whether it's just inherent or whether it's for commercial reasons, when they get the chance, Josie Falbo, to get into the Lakeside Singers and explore their classical side, what does it do for them?
Well, it's a learning process. I mean, we learned from each other. And to produce a sound in a particular genre that would be authentic. You know, if we're going to do a classical song, we're going to learn from the people who've done classical all the time. And they're going to learn, by the same token, the people who've done jazz and on every kind of pop genre, they're going to learn that kind of sound and learn how to produce it so that each song we do is going to be authentic. It's going to be right. It's going to have the right sound.
So in a sense, it's learning different musical languages, for lack of a better...
Yeah, it's more like learning dialects.
Interesting. Mm-hmm.
Each one of these...
Music is the language.
Music is a language, and if you specialize in country music, you learn a certain kind of vocal decoration that's common. You learn that whole genre, that style. And it's totally different than an R&B singer and certainly from a classical singer. And in fact, one great source of humor is to have a classical singer try to sing a country song in the classical style. It cracks everybody up all the time.
This is behind the scenes of the Lakeside Singers.
Well,
you make
sure,
me, yeah.
Sure.
Why don't we hear? You brought a couple samples in, Bob.
Right.
Buddy.
I've got a couple things.
The great engineer Dan Long.
Let me just say that this, to celebrate our 20th anniversary, we commissioned four new pieces this year, and one is an arrangement of Jerome Turn. The song is You, and it's arranged by Paul Langford in a style similar to Gene Perling, vocal jazz, a cappella, very kind of dense harmonies, but at the core is this beautiful Jerome Kern song. So I've got a little sample of us rehearsing a couple weeks ago.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, you be the judge of that.
Forever inside of me.
Well, I'm sold. I'm sold. Who gets the notion? Whose idea is it to do that, Bob? Yours?
Well, we decided to commission four works, and we have two that are very much in the classical field, and this is a vocal jazz arrangement. And
when you commission, you don't commission to say, hey, do something.
Well, usually what happens in this particular case with Paul Langford, the arranger, he said, well, I'd love to do you have a specific theme? And I said, give me four of your favorite songs and let's talk about them and see where we want to go. I also didn't want, because the classical things are, one is very atonal, very angular, one is very pretty. We wanted a lot of variety in the package. So that's what we sell, is variety.
Well, did you do a Christmas show this year?
No, of course. Our 20th annual, absolutely.
Yeah, I missed it.
And this coming season. Well
this season, again, and we will talk after the break. We got to take another commercial break. And what that means is that people listen, because otherwise people wouldn't pay to have commercials. At least it's our hope. Dan Long, Ben Anderson, and I don't run the station, but we got to figure if you're buying commercials here that somebody's listening, or you've been led to believe or fooled to believe that someone's listening. We will talk after the break about the specific places where the Lakeside Singers will be. They will be in Evanston Friday, Naperville Saturday, and on Chicago, right across from that place that I will always call the Hancock Building. On
me too.
On the 26th. I mean, life can change, but it doesn't. I still call Marshall Fields Marshall Fields.
I do too.
For God's sake. You should go to lakesidesingers.com, because at that site you can order the CDs. How many of them are there now, Bob?
We have seven.
Wow!
But you can get three of them on iTunes and all those Apple, Spotify. They're all over there.
What do you mean? I want them to buy them from you.
No, you can buy our CDs, but you can also download them if you're a download person.
Well, I'm no download person.
All right.
Yeah, you can do it that way. We want to spread the word of the Lakeside Singers. That's what we want to do. They come from all over the place. And how many are there now?
24.
Wow.
Yeah,
24. Has that been a standard number all these years?
Yes, sometimes I go 25.
Well, wait a minute. No, that's wrong. Because originally there was just one, and her name was Josie Falbo, right?
That's how it started.
It was just Lakeside Singer. Singers, right? We will take a short commercial break and come back. You'll hear another tune, and we'll tell you more about the... It's a remarkable thing to celebrate 20 years doing anything, let alone making people happy with music, as the Lakeside Singers have been doing low these 20 years. We'll be right back. Welcome back. We have a few more minutes with Bob Bowker and Josie Falbo and Barb Bailey from the Lakeside Singers. Barb doesn't sing, or doesn't sing like she used to. Bob started the thing with one member. That first member was Josie. And when you started this group that would combine, sort of bridge the world between classical and contemporary choral music with pop music, who else was doing that?
No one. And actually, to my knowledge, there's only one other group in Italy that is trying to do what we do today.
What do you
think? That is to be as thoroughly researched in the style so that the classical stuff is really classical, the stuff that was designed to be performed in an acoustical space.
Gotcha.
But the second half, all the pop stuff was written with the idea that it was going to be amplified. Mm-hmm. So we use mics to do that, just to make sure that stylistically it sounds right.
Yeah. You're going to be performing, and I want you to talk about Nichols Hall in Evanston.
Oh, yeah.
If you have never been, I mean, seeing the Lakeside Singers at the Billy Goat under Michigan Avenue is a great place to see them, but Nichols Hall was built as a Christian Science church.
That's right.
Many, many years ago before it was converted as part of the Music Institute of Chicago. It's one of the most remarkable music spaces I've ever seen or heard, isn't it, Bob, Josie?
Definitely, yes.
You like performing there.
I loved, especially the first half. Acoustically, it's wonderful. We can hear each other. The audience can hear everything we do. It's a gem.
Yeah. It's a live mm-hmm. space that's welcoming not only for the audience, but the performers can hear themselves very well.
And there's an intimacy to it, too.
They can hear audience response, and you rarely get all three of that in one package.
Where do you perform in Naperville?
Right now, we are at the Grace United Methodist Church, the Grace United Methodist Church in Naperville. It's a wonderful space. It's like a 400-seat capacity,
wow.
But it's live, and it's worked out very well for us.
Now, the Evanston, Nichols Hall, that show is this Friday. Naperville is next Saturday. And Chicago, on the 26th, you perform at a sort of notable church, don't you?
Yes, you've avoided naming it as the Fourth Presbyterian.
Hey, I avoid every church. I avoid all churches. Yeah, it's
Fourth Presbyterian. They probably avoid you, too.
Yes. You don't get barred from churches, but I suppose I have been barred from a few. It's the Fourth Presbyterian Church, that
wonderful,
remarkable building on Michigan Avenue.
Yes, it is. And a beautiful place to sing, especially the classical half is really translates well in that reverberant space.
You've sent engineer Dan Long, who's helping out tonight, a piece of classical stuff from the Lakeside Singers. What is it?
This is one of our other commissions. We'll be having the world premiere of this and the other arrangement that you just heard this Friday night. This is written by Marianne Kim, who happens to be our accompanist, but she's published more than 200 pieces.
Wow.
She's a well-known composer. And this piece is kind of based on Gregorian chant, and the text is in Latin, but it dates from the 4th century, and it basically says wherever there is charity and love, that is where God is. And so here's a little excerpt of it. It's a beautiful piece.
It's a nice thought.
Lovely, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really, really lovely. Josie, what do you think of that?
Oh, I think it's absolutely beautiful. It's one of my favorite pieces in the whole concert.
How many songs are you singing in this
Well, this concert, we were talking about being eclectic. We're doing a Serbian folk song. We're doing something from South Africa. We're doing a 15th century madrigal. We're doing this brand new piece.
Don't forget the Italian piece. Hello.
Italian piece, an Italian madrigal. And well, then we're doing country music and R&B and gospel and some spirituals. So it's
how often? How often do you gather? I know every one of the Lakeside Singers is busy making a living doing singing or other jobs. How often are you able to get together to rehearse?
We rehearse on Monday nights because that's when the theater is dark, and I've got several people.
You rehearse every month? Try to rehearse every month?
Yeah, pretty much.
Or like a couple months before the show?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
12 or 13 times before we hit stage.
And are there any jealousy? You tell me this, Josie. Are there any? I know there are 20-some, couple dozen members. I mean, does everybody in this group get along?
Oh, my gosh. We are, they're wonderful. There is not even a smidgen. We are so supportive of each other and so respectful of each other's talents and gifts, you know. It's just a wonderful group.
I guess one of the reasons for that is you all understand being in the arts, what it takes, sacrifice on personal, professional, and certainly financial levels to be in the arts. You understand the shared sacrifice.
I would add to that that there are very few singers that I've ever worked with that have Josie's range. Almost everyone else has a very strong suit and some other weaker suits. And so it's not like nine sopranos auditioning for the one classical solo and they're all classical singers.
Right.
The people who specialize in country and R&B are very appreciative of the people who sing in styles that they're not as strong in. And so they have respect for that, and that helps keep things nice and happy.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Very true.
Let's hear, before we end this thing, there's one more piece. What's the last thing you wrote?
Right, this is a Paul Simon song, and it's arranged by Darman Meter. It's in a vocal jazz style with a band, Me and Julio, Down by the Schoolyard.
The bomb put you on the roll out of bed, and you ran to the police station. When the papa found out, he began to shout and started the investigation. It's against the law. It was against the law. What the mama saw was against the law.
Where the mama looked down, spit on the ground. Every time the name gets mentioned. And the papa said, oh, if you get that boy, I'm gonna stick him in the house of detention.
Well, I'm on my way. I don't know where I'm going.
And the radical priests come to get me released. He's all on the cover of Newsweek.
And I'm on my way. I don't know where I'm going. I'm on my way.
Okay, that too is fantastic. It's not like I don't know the Lakeside Singers, and you guys are great, but what we played during this 40-minute segment has been fantastic. And no wonder you guys get excited about it. Do you commission new arrangements for every show?
Yes. Pretty much we try to tailor-make. Most of the music that's published, especially for popular music, is designed for an educational use, high schools, that sort of thing. So we instead have the luxury of having several of our members, like John Negus, do arrangements for us that tailor it to us and get closer to the original, for the original recording.
Wow.
So
that.
That's what we do.
Josie Falbo is in the studio. She is now concentrating on the concerts, Lakeside Singer concerts, Friday, Saturday, and on the 26th. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, you're in the studio crafting other songs to go with the fabulous song we heard there. When is that going to be ready, Jesse?
Hopefully in the summer, around July, latter part of July.
And it's just fabulous. Bob Bowker working with you on this?
Bob Bowker has produced some of the vocals. Joni Pilato has.
Oh, and, good
yes,
Joni.
My good friend Joni. And yeah, we're getting close. We're getting very close.
There's still, just in mentioning Joni's name and some of the people you've mentioned, Bob, this is an amazing, amazing musical community called Chicago.
Sure
is. It
sure
not?
It
absolutely.
Sure is.
Yes. So much happening. Yeah.
So much happening and so much, I think, giving and willingness to collaborate and help in any way. Don't you think?
I agree.
Oh, yes.
That's what makes Bob Barker a genius.
Because I agree.
He agreed with me. They're one of the rare musical things I'm saying. Barb Bailey, who does a great deal of work promoting and fostering, and Josie Falbo.
Yes.
20 years of the Lakeside Singers. You guys probably could never, you probably never had a bad concert, did you, Bob?
Moments.
Yeah, I bet there was a moment.
20 years, yeah. We've had some fear.
Yeah.
But generally, it's been really, really positive. And so we're still at it.
Well, it was a great thing you did to start this thing, and Josie was among the first. Were you the first? The very first?
I think so.
She was. She can always be called the Lakeside Singer.
Yeah,
but you guys can, you people can all go to the lakesidesingers.com to get more information about the shows, to buy the CDs, and to learn about this incredible Chicago musical treasure.
Yeah, very kind, thank you.
Creative
thank
treasure. You. I've always loved it. Thanks to Ben Anderson for producing this show, to the great Dan Long, former producer who's gone up in the world engineering this whole thing and tossing, you know, emails back and forth. All of you for listening, that's what really matters. And go see the Lakeside Singers. I will see you on the radio next Sunday.